Welcome back to the program. Long before the 1% versus the 99%, upstairs and downstairs represented two separate worlds. Back in the 19th century, the time of Jane Austen and Pride and Prejudice, the gap was perhaps even wider than it is today. It was a time of social unrest and a time when just the task of doing laundry often took months to prepare. In fact, we can learn a lot about class, about service, and about human dignity by looking at the other half of Pride and Prejudice, the people who, like service workers today, make things happen. This is the focus of Joe Baker's new historical novel, Longbourn. Joe Baker was educated at Oxford and Queen's University in Belfast. She's the author of four previous novels, and it is my pleasure to welcome her here today to talk about her latest, Longbourn. Joe Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit about the general idea of Longbourn, the notion of the downstairs point of view of Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, so it's something that just started to fascinate me. I'm a lifelong fan of Austen, but reading her books, I was always aware of the servant's presence. They're sometimes their name, sometimes they're not. Sometimes things get done that need someone to do it, but the person who does it isn't mentioned. But my family, until quite recently, worked in service. My grandma worked as a maid when she was a young woman, and so I was kind of more alert to those moments than I otherwise would have been, I think. And that's where it all started from, really.
And those moments, whether they're in Pride and Prejudice or in real life, I suppose, when somebody says things like bring the car around or do the laundry or whatever has to happen, there's somebody there that actually is doing that.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I just became aware that there were other human beings in the room in Pride and Prejudice, and they didn't have voices, they weren't being spoken to or about, and that just really fascinated me because, you know, those are people whose I share a background with, and I just wanted to, you know, give them a chance to have a story and to, you know, be fully realized, and that's what I was keen to do, really.
And talk a little bit about the cast, Sarah, and the cast of characters that you've assembled in Longbourn.
Okay. So there's Sarah. She's the only servant who gets given her given name in Pride and Prejudice. She's one of the two Longbourn housemaids that are mentioned. She's been working there since she was apprenticed at the age of six, which is quite normal for the period and that situation. And then there's Mrs. Hill, who is also named in Pride and Prejudice, but just as Mrs. Hill, and she's a housekeeper. And then there's also a butler and a footman mentioned in Pride and Prejudice, so they don't get given names. So in my version, in my imagining, Mr. Hill, well, the butler becomes Mr. Hill because quite often they did have that sort of husband and wife team below stairs. And when we join the book, when the story starts, it's just before the new footman joins the household. So he's the new arrival that's being brought into the household.
Talk about the way in which the servants and all the people downstairs are impacted by what's going on upstairs, by the lives of these people, and things that they can't control and yet have very powerful influences on them.
Yes, I mean, that became really fascinating for me as I was writing the book. These people have a story of their own. They each individually have a story, but they're also, you know, they're sideswiped by the events of Austen's novel. So one thing that occurred to me as I was just thinking around this was, you know, Mr. Collins, who is going to inherit Longbourn, the house, when Mr. Bennet dies. It's very important to Mrs. Bennet that he marry one of her daughters, because then they get to stay in the house. But what matters to the people below stairs is that he marries someone who's prepared to keep them on, because when he inherits, and he will inherit, he could just choose to completely replace his staff. So that, you know, there's a real sort of, particularly with Mrs. Hill, there's a real urge for that continuity and security in a very uncertain world. These are very unsettled times historically. And so the notion of this inheritance is, you know, is important in Pride and Prejudice, but it's also important in Longbourn. And there are these moments throughout the novel where the events of Austen's story, you know, push my characters in different directions as well.
put it in the context of the times, because it really was a period of great social unrest and great yeah. class struggle, although you yeah. don't see that struggle inherently in Longbourn.
Yeah, this is a time of, well, Napoleonic Wars are at a high pitch, and that's something that I found quite sort of interesting, because this is as a result of the Napoleonic Wars. Men servants are at a particular premium, so they've got high taxes on them and command high wages, because men are really wanted for, able-bodied young men are wanted for the army and the navy, and if not that, to plow and till the land, because there's a blockade, the trade is minimal, you know, at this point. So Britain has to be self-sufficient, and the idea of men standing around wearing white gloves serving soup, it was something the government was massively trying to discourage with these taxes. But the taxes made having a manservant actually very fashionable. So it had that kind of opposite effect. So that's going on. But also alongside that, there are the Luddite riots happening in the sort of northern Midlands of Britain, which is where the industrial workers who are being made redundant by new machinery are beginning to get organized and rebel against what's being done to them. They're basically losing their work and therefore, you know, just starving. There's nothing very much to support them in that situation. And that, for me, was very much connected with the presence of the militia, who in Pride and Prejudice are this source of romantic interest and drama in Meryton. But I know that in other parts of the country, I don't know what's going on in Meryton, I can only speculate why they're there, but certainly further north and in other parts of the country, the militia are there to keep down political unrest and rioting. And so for me, that was a really interesting thing to uncover and to think about, was what the militia are up to. If not in Meryton, then, you know, will be up to in other places in the country before too long.
The other question is the degree to which Sarah and all the other people downstairs have a sense of what is going on in the wider world.
Mm. Mm. Well, they do have, in Pride and Prejudice, Mr. Bennett takes a newspaper. We see him disappear behind it quite often. One thing that would happen is that newspapers would get handed on and handed round. And I feel Mr. Bennett is generally quite benign. And so, you know, the reading material is available downstairs. And, you know, discussion does happen about the events that are unfolding. Certainly Sarah has her eyes on the horizon. She's very keen to know about what's going on in the wider world and to experience some of it. And Mrs. Hill, you know, also has a sort of sense of what's going on, but is afraid rather than eager to experience anything beyond, you know, the confines of their backwater, really.
Most of the people that are working there seem relatively content with their lot. There isn't this sense of aspiration, or is there? Talk a little about that.
Well, I think there's, they vary. I mean, I think Mrs. Hill is someone who's very settled in where she is, and has, as in Pride and Prejudice, is a sort of a fixture of the household. But I think, to some degree, the younger members of the servantry, if you will, have got more of an eye on what else there might be. I mean, the issue really is that options are very limited for people of that class. There isn't really very much else that you can do apart from, you know, industrial labor in the new factories, or agricultural labor, or service, or join the army. And so with these limited options, you know, you could well be yearning for something better, but, there just isn't the chance. There's no class mobility is really very minimal indeed. I think the one thing that they do have that some of them grasp very eagerly is any opportunity for education, for sort of finding out about the world and for learning. And this is certainly true of Sarah. And as things unfold, we sort of learn more about some of the other characters in that respect as well.
There's also a hierarchy of aspiration even within those engaged in service that we start to see.
I think there's, I mean, if you're thinking about Ptolemy, who comes in with the Netherfield household, he's one of the, when Mr. Bingley comes to Netherfield, he brings servants with him, and they have a degree of, they seem sophisticated compared with what Sarah's used to locally. They come from London, they have, they seem to offer a glimpse of something a bit more exciting than she's used to. And, Ptolemy has this aspiration basically to join the middle classes, it's a small body of the sort of shopkeepers or artisans or something like that, and he's doing it, he's plugging away at that. I know some readers have said that it's moving, that what his aspiration is, what he really wants in all the world is to, well, I don't want to give too much away, I don't suppose I am just saying he wants to open up a shop. And that's, it's possibly within his grasp, but it means a lot of hard work in the meantime if he's going to make it come real.
The other question is whether or not when these characters are neglected in something like Pride and Prejudice, whether it is an oversight, whether it is simply that it would be overcomplicating, or the degree to which it is dehumanizing in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's absolutely true. I think, I'm sure that there are sort of questions about cluttering a text. I mean, as a novelist myself, I know that you don't want to be juggling, a crowd scene when what you really want is the intimate conversation between your two main characters. And Austin's so spectacularly brilliant at these socially driven stories and characterizations. So one thing that becomes very clear about Pride and Prejudice when you really, really look at it is how little description there is. Everything happens through conversation and between people and in social context. And I think that's part of why, these servants only just appear so, like these little minnow flickers of activity, because to bring them in would just be to muddy, I'm mixing my metaphor here, but it would be to muddy the water. They're there to serve the story, and that's, certainly part of what's going on. But actually, Austin's novel was praised by one reviewer for not having any chambermaids in it, because I think when they appeared in fiction at this time, they were tended to be, if you think of something like Pamela, aside from Pamela herself, a lot of the servants there are quite, the novel, a lot of the servants there are quite, there's a sort of degree of vulgarity or crookedness in that. And so it's partly about keeping the palate nice and clean, I think, that it doesn't bring in the servantry too much. But it still fascinated me that those voices were not being spoken. She's actually very warm towards servants in her letters, and it's actually I find those really interesting to read as a companion to the novels.
The other part of the work of servantry is that we can't think about it in a contemporary context. The work was hard and very consuming, not in the context of what we might think of labor-saving devices in the home today.
Yeah. They're basically the white goods of their day. They're the washing machines and the dishwashers and, all of those goods we're used to sort of loading up and pressing a button. they're doing the labor that's involved with that. And it changes you physically. It's hard and it's long. It keeps on going from before dawn till after dusk. And it also is a lifetime's work as well. When you think about these little children being taken from the poorhouse and apprenticed, which is to say, that the local poor law commissioners actually paid to have the children taken off their hands and trained up in this way. And they'd be starting at 6 years old, and working until the point where they could no longer work, and then could well end up in the poorhouse again if they didn't have a benign employer who would be happy to keep them on in their decrepitude. It was a tough life. It really was.
Tell us a little bit about your adventure in taking on something of this magnitude, the idea of a parallel story to Pride and Prejudice?
Well, I started to, people have been asking me about this, and I realized what it is a subquel. You know, it's not a prequel or a sequel, it's a subquel. It's what's going on underneath. To be honest with you, the impact of it only really hit home once I'd sent the book to my agent and she started sending it out. I was doing this so quietly. I was doing it completely for myself, really. it was something that had been fascinating me for years and I wanted to explore, but I wasn't really that, a reviewer described it as delightfully audacious, and I do realize now retrospectively that it was audacious. But at the time I was just happily exploring this world because, you know, I love Austin. I love that world. I love losing myself in it. And this was just an opportunity for me to quite playfully leave those formal rooms and go downstairs into the kitchen and go out the back door and across the yard, you know, into the stables and things like that. And so for me it was quite a sort of playful experience and quite a fun thing to do. And it was only when the foreign rights started to sell and it sold here in the US, which it actually sold in the US before it sold in the UK, and then, you know, the film deal and things like that, that's when I started to think, oh no, what have I done? What are people going to say? Because people, you know, have a lot of a vested interest in this novel. People love, I mean, Pride and Prejudice. But I think anyone who reads my book will quite quickly see how much it comes from a place of admiration for Austen and love for those books and respect for her as a writer.
Joe Baker, the novel is Longbourn. Joe, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. Thank you.
We'll take a break. I'll be right back.